We have a live interview with Andrew and Brenna Bird, the linguists who created the languages of Far Cry Primal. But first, I got to try an HTC Vive Pre this week, and I'll tell you why it's more expensive than the Rift. Tonight is March 13th, 2016, and the Bobby Blackwell Show, it's up next. So you would say even if... Okay, I'll let you go. You talk. Wow, what happened to your voice? Thank you, Skype. So video games, that's what the show is about.
This is that one Akia Ripper from Sweden.
And what's with all the Halo hate, Bob? You've been hating on Halo a lot lately.
I just don't like shooters. I'm not saying it's a bad game, I just don't like it. Billy O.K. says he can't be seen in public playing games that aren't hardcore. What would people say? And what up, G and Chad is once again talking about wrestling. That's why. It's not because they hate the fans. It's more because they have to start from scratch.
Hogwash. Later.
From a little room in Atlanta, Georgia, Bobby Blackwell.
Losing an hour sucks, I agree. We need to just get rid of the daylight savings time. Farmers don't need it anymore. That's why we have it here in the States. Hello, everybody, and welcome to, I guess it's an hour earlier edition, even though it's not really, but it is, but it's not. Welcome to this edition, I guess, of the Bobby Blackwell Show, where we discuss the current news affecting the video game industry, as well as sometimes reminiscing about gaming's history. My name is Bobby Blackwell. You are joining us live here in the at the Voice of Geeks Network. Welcome. Just like Fluke says, daylight savings is good for Fluke. He's in the UK, so now we're an hour earlier for him. So I guess it works out for him. Maybe we should just keep this earlier time. Yeah. But if you're joining us over at the Voice of Geeks Network, welcome. Head on over to our chat room. It is live.vognetwork.com. That is where I'll be trying to read intelligent comments and intelligent questions tonight here on the show. And if you are on the site and logged in, you can check in. Just like SSJ100 Matt and Dark Tetsuya, they checked in at some point during the intro to the show. And they got some points. If you're listening on the podcast feed somewhere in this episode, you will hear a passphrase that you can put in to get the exact same amount of points on the site for bragging rights. And you can take down Tiger Claw, because that's what we all want, I guess. Usually I would open up the Skype line and the toll-free number for you to call in later tonight, but I'm not going to be doing that tonight because... we actually have an interview at the second half of the show. It's the first time I've done this at the second half of the show. And it's about Far Cry Primal. And I've actually, Andrew and Brenna Bird are going to be coming on at 8:30. The Speaking Primal Twitter account is run by Andrew. And I actually knew Andrew back in college. And so now that his commitments to Ubisoft's PR are up, he can talk to me because Ubisoft didn't want to answer my emails and have me talk to them earlier. So we're going to talk to him about being a linguist and creating languages for Far Cry Primal. That is going to be in for the live listeners probably in about 20, 25 minutes from now. So get your questions ready. Breakman's like, haha, intelligent questions. We have some intelligent people in this room, and they can ask, and I'll read those. And then I won't read the ones from Breakman and Raginator. And then, you know, watch this. They're going to surprise me and ask a question. So that's over at live.vognetwork.com. You can join that chat room. So one thing I do like to do before I really get into anything really substantive is I want to talk about last week's episode, and I want to talk about comments received at voiceofgeeksnetwork.com on the episode page. You can go to the episode page over at vognetwork.com, and I show links and show all my receipts to everything, to most everything I talk about. And you can leave comments. And we got one from the last episode from Flacco Jones. We were talking about No Man's Sky, and he says, I already ordered No Man's Sky, even though I usually focus on games that are very linear and story-centric. With this game, my approach will be the polar opposite. I'll likely stick to just exploring and discovering things on my own terms and not bother with finding the center of the universe or playing the game in a traditional sort of way. I just love space so much, and this looks like the perfect space game. I don't need a story this time, and I'm sure it'll be worth the $47.99 Amazon Prime price. And I responded that. I'm like, Amazon Prime price? And I went over, and it was $59.99 at Amazon. I was like, oh, that's so sad. And then Rob from OLR said, no, no, you just have to actually order it, and you get that price. And so now I have gotten it at the $47.99 Amazon Prime price. Because I am an Amazon Prime member. So it is available, the hard copy only, which means it won't get unlocked at midnight. So you'll have to wait for them to actually deliver it on release day. But yes, so I've got my copy ordered. And it's kind of like Minecraft actually has an objective. The objective of Minecraft is to, I guess, defeat the Ender Dragon at the end. You're supposed to go into the Nether and defeat the dragon, I think. And that's like actually like the point of Minecraft. But most people ignore that. And I think that a lot of people are going to ignore that in No Man's Sky as well. I'm very excited for it. I think I will get a lot of use out of my $60 or my $47.99 that you can get too if you're an Amazon Prime member. I think up to 2 weeks before you can get it at that price. So you have a couple months to order it at that price. Breakman says, a tangible copy that is so 2012. Here's why I still like tangible copies. It's because it installs most of the game from that tangible copy, and I live in that area that has bandwidth caps. Very high bandwidth caps, but bandwidth caps nonetheless. So anytime I can actually install a game locally and then have it only get the updates from the internet, downloading, even if it's like a 3-gig update, is better than downloading 40 gigs from the internet. Fifth Dream says it's 2 weeks after you can get it at that price. So 2 weeks after it comes out. So you could wait for the reviews and then get it for that price. Amazon Prime is great. Also, I wanted to kind of go back. I didn't get a comment about this, but about all the stuff that I was saying about Microsoft and the Universal Windows apps that I was talking about last week. One thing that I didn't mention on my show that I did mention on OLR is that, you know, we talked a lot about people who were kind of against Microsoft's direction, and especially like Tim Sweeney of Epic Games saying that this could be a very bad thing for PC gamers. And one thing I didn't bring up on my show is that I'm hoping that the same thing happens here that happened with the Xbox One. And here's why I'm going to say that. When Microsoft started coming out with some of their details about how they were going to handle used games, family sharing and all that stuff, they said, oh, we're going to require an internet connection at all times and stuff. And they were phrasing it in such a way that it was going to be good for gamers. You can have your games available anywhere, no matter where you are. It's not, you know, tied to anything physical. It's your account in the cloud. And everybody rallied against that, so they changed their position. And they took away certain parts of what they were fundamentally going to do with Xbox One, took it away to basically acquiesce to what we wanted. And so I'm hoping that happens again, that they're not going to lock down parts of the Universal Windows platform to only apps that are purchased through the Windows 10 store. They've have a history of doing that in the past, and I applaud them for doing it in the past, and I hope that they do it again. I hope that if enough people speak up, then they'll change their minds. And I've heard, you know, some people were saying, well, if it's just like your friends list and your achievements, why, you know, you can only use Steam achievements if you're on Steam, you know, why should this be any different? And if Tim Sweeney of Epic Games, which is a big Microsoft partner, if he was worried enough about the stuff that he knew under his non-disclosure agreement that I know he has with Microsoft, and if he was worried enough to go public in the way that he did, saying, hey, they're going down a bad path, I kind of believe that they have plans that we don't know about yet, Microsoft does, that is probably a bad idea. And I think he's trying to get the public informed without violating his NDA, which is probably a very tricky line for him to toe. So I don't think if it was just friends list and just achievements on the and that's all they were locking off to Universal Windows platform and the Windows 10 store, if that's all it was, then I don't think he would have had as big of an issue. So that's kind of why I was bringing all that stuff up, and I didn't make that clear last week, but I made it clear this week, and that's all that really matters. So one quick piece of housekeeping. I actually did finish, I don't know if I can call it a movie or a documentary or something. It's a little bit longer than a traditional YouTube video, which means it's actually longer than most episodes of this podcast. Not every episode of this podcast, but it's a little bit longer than the vast majority of episodes of this podcast. I released on the VOG Network YouTube channel my road trip diary from MAGFest. About a month after the road trip happened, that's how long it kind of took me to get all the footage together. And it basically kind of chronicles how I did the trip, because I drive an electric vehicle. I drive a Tesla Model S. And I talk all about through the trip. Basically, I go through each supercharger, show, you know, make a stop at each supercharger, and then I talk about a feature of the car in between each stop. So it comes out to a little bit over an hour. It's up on the Vogue Network YouTube channel. So if you've kind of wondered what it's like, and, you know, have some of your questions answered, obviously not all of your questions answered, but some of the questions answered about doing a long trip in an electric vehicle, which does not take gas at all, that video is up, and you're more than welcome to spend an hour watching it, because I spent probably 40 to 60 hours making it. So that'd be cool. So it's over at the Vogue Network YouTube channel, and we also have a story about it at VogueNetwork.com. Breakman asks, what's it like to be rich like Bobby? I wish I was rich. I bought a Tesla, so I'm no longer rich. Sorry about that. So this week, I got to try the HTC Vive, thanks to our friends over at ATL VR, who've been a big supporter of this show, and we've supported their virtual reality meetups and stuff, even broadcast from there. They were able to get an HTC Vive Pre, which is kind of like the final developer kit before the consumer release next month. The Vive, the reason the Vive is different, where they're differentiating themselves from the Oculus Rift, is that the Vive is really pushing room scale VR experiences, which is you're going to be standing up and you've got the two hand controllers that are tracked in 3D space and you're tracked in 3D space. And it's really pushing that over the seated experience with a controller, an Xbox controller, that the Oculus Rift is starting with. And I had never tried a Vive before. But I have tried the consumer version of the Oculus Rift. And I've tried their Oculus Touch controllers. I went in saying, you know, well, one thing also is I want to kind of start getting ideas about developing for it, because even though it's not a developer kit, you can still develop for it and kind of get some background on that, because I have done some VR development, especially also with my day job. And I wanted to kind of figure out what was different and if it really pulled off what they said it did. And I'm going to say that it did. The reason that the HTC Vive is $200 more than the Rift is basically because of the hand controllers. It has two hand controllers that are tracked in 3D space from the lighthouse sensors. This is going to be the hardest part of people getting the Vive, is placing those sensors, because they have to be above you, basically, when you're standing up. You can sit down and use the Vive as well, but the sensors need to be able to see you when you're sitting down as well. And they have to kind of be mounted, like, on the walls. So you've got to figure out where you're going to mount them. Especially if you're going to be mobile, like if you're going to take it around and demo it other places, figuring out, like, what type of stands to get. And I think, I might have to get a light kit like that professional photographers get for their 3-point lighting, and take the lights off and mount the lighthouse stands on there, because it has to be taller than like traditional speaker stands that you might have in a home theater setup. So what these do is that there's a camera on the front of the Vive that detect the infrared coming out of the lighthouse sensors, which all the lighthouse sensors need is power. They don't connect to your computer, so you don't need to worry about that. They just need to be able to have power. It's kind of like the Wii sensor, the sensor bar. All it really needs is power, even though it gets that power from the Wii. It just emits things that the Wii remote then detects. Those sensors completely make the experience. And it's really going to be interesting. GDC is going on this week. Oculus has something in their pocket sleeve or in their back pocket that they're going to announce. And I think it's going to have to be something that is a competitor to the room scale VR, because the hardware here is really it's what makes it. And if I was looking at the Oculus Rift that we know right now and the HTC Vive side by side, I'm going to say that the HTC Vive is the better product. It's the better hardware. Oculus might actually have the better software. But thanks to what Valve is doing with their Steam VR SDK, Steam VR is platform independent. So people can make their game for Steam VR, and it'll work with both the Oculus Rift and the HTC 5 out of the box. I was talking to Peter from ATL VR, and he actually says he actually develops his Vive experiences with a dev kit, too, of the Oculus Rift. But that same executable, he then takes over to where the HTC Vive is set up, and it works just fine. So it's platform independent. So what I'm thinking is that, you know, it might be a good idea to, you know, get games from the Oculus Store, games that are made only be on the Oculus Store, and play them on your Vive, because the Vive might actually be a better solution. It's obviously not perfect. Neither will the Oculus Rift be, but it's really good. And the screen door effect obviously is gone. Visually, it didn't seem any different than the consumer version of the Rift on the inside when I put the headset on. And I even played the same game on both. I've played Job Simulator on both the Oculus Rift consumer version and the HTC Vive Pre. The only difference actually is kind of a negative on the Vive is that the hand controllers for the Vive do not detect finger movement, whereas the Oculus Touch does. And in Job Simulator, when you want to turn on the computer or turn on the monitor, you actually have to have your finger outstretched. But there's no way for the Vive controllers to tell that, so you don't actually have to do that. The Vive controllers actually look, for one for each hand, they kind of look like the Oculus Touch sensors, but it's got the big trackpad. So if you've used a Steam controller, the right trackpad, you have that on both. But they are mapped usually in 3D space right in front of you, so you can actually look down and they have a 3D model of the controller. It's got a menu button, another button, and then I think two triggers on the underside, and then that big trackpad, which you can use as a mouse. And they fully integrated Steam Big Picture into VR mode with like a laser pointer, and you can scroll up and down. But really, the app that I got to try in the Vive that I think really encapsulates the entire experience is the Google productivity tool that is shipping with the Vive, and it's called Tilt Brush. I knew about it. We even talked about it a little bit on the show, but I didn't really get it until I put the Vive on and tried Tilt Brush. So what Tilt Brush is basically it allows you to paint in 3D space. So your right hand is your actual paint brush. And as you hold down the trigger and you know, that puts paint out and you draw kind of in the air. But then you can walk around to behind it and then draw behind it. And you're winding up drawing a 3D painting, which is cool in its own right. And then I, you know, had my left, and I was like, so what does my left hand do? And I was getting no instructions. Like, they just put me in it and said, okay, just go do it. And then they, Annie and Peter went off and did, like, businessy type stuff. And then I had my left hand, and suddenly it became kind of an easel. And I flipped over the easel. I flipped over my hand like I was holding an easel, and I could actually use the right hand to flip through different brush strokes, different colors, and other things, and, you know, select them, and then go back and actually like put in effects around my drawing. And then when you save it and you play it back, it actually animates it. And it is very fast animation, but you actually watch it being drawn. And you can walk around as it's being drawn in your 15-foot by 15-foot space maximum. It'll work in smaller spaces as well. That is the one thing that's going to show people, okay, this is what VR does differently than other things. Fifth Dream says, 20 years of VR and all the games are still tech demos. Well, this specifically is a tech demo. It's not a game. Raginator asks, 3D painting, what is the TTP on that? I'm not going to define that acronym, but it's pretty quick. And Breakman even says, 3D painting actually sounds really cool. And it actually is cooler than it sounds. It's one of those you kind of have to see it to understand it. And I can see some very artistic people really spending time in there. They actually have a mannequin that you can put in there. And actually, you can paint a dress onto the mannequin, paint a 3D dress onto the 3D mannequin, and actually do clothes design in this. So I think that's kind of where this is going to shine. If you don't have a room that's 15 foot by 15 foot, which is fine, which is most people, even the room I'm in right now is 12 foot by 12 foot, and there's stuff all around. So I'm not even going to have that much space. It does actually, like, I think, like, it tells you to scan your room so it can see where all the obstacles are before you actually start using it, because it's got a camera on the front. And then if you get close to anything, it'll actually show you a wireframe of a wall and kind of tell you to stop. And it was even doing this when I was getting too close to a cabinet. So it's not just the walls. It's actually detecting cabinets and stuff like that. So it does work pretty well. I didn't see the room scanning portion of it. And we were in a pretty big space at their office. This was at the ATLVR office in downtown Atlanta. And it does do its best to stop you from hurting yourself. It does have a camera on the front that it actually can use as a webcam, so you can call it up as a normal webcam. And it will even like show you kind of a 3D representation of your room, even though it's not truly 3D. It's still a 2D representation. They call it Tron mode. But you can actually like look around and see things and stuff. But it's also got a full color webcam as well that's activated as any other webcam. So I think that the Vive honestly does have the better hardware of the two. The Oculus Rift is obviously going to have the better software, I believe, because people have been working with the Oculus Rift for much longer, at least at first. There is going to be the Oculus Store, and at least Steam VR is all Steam. So, you know, that's what we already have. I hope there's not going to be too much fragmentation of software. But I'm really looking. I'm back in the VR game right now. I don't know if you've ever been able to tell. I kind of got a little cold on VR for about a year or two because it didn't run on my system. And the DK2, it was more of a hassle to get things running on the second dev kit than it really should have been, which is fine because it's a dev kit and not a consumer model. But I'm back in. Like this, that just using the Vive for the 20 minutes that I was able to use it earlier this week, I'm back in. I ordered myself a desktop, and yes, it's a pre-built desktop, which is the first time I've ever done that, which I got a lot of shifty eyes on Twitter for saying that, but I got one of the Oculus Ready desktops, it's one of the Asus ones, the Republic of Gamers. It was the high-end one, so it's got the GTX 980 and all that stuff, and I priced all the components myself, and I priced my time and how much it would take for me to do it myself, and I think I would have saved $20 doing it myself. And I don't feel like it. I don't feel like building a new computer right now. Next time I make a real computer that's going to be my main machine, yeah, I'm going to build it myself. But this is not going to replace my main machine or anything like that. So you can keep your shifty eyes to yourself. I bought a pre-built desktop to be able to play my games and play my VR. And it's a small one, so I can actually take it with me to places. So it's not going to be a machine that stays in my office. It's actually going to help with doing demos and going to cons and stuff like that. So it's more than just my new home machine. Breakman says his reality has just been torn. He thought I built my own systems. I did. I've built every other desktop in this house. I built myself. Just this one time, I was like, I don't have the time or the desire to spend a day putting stuff together and running around finding the components and buying the CPU from here and attaching it to the motherboard that I had to get from here and buying the GPU from here and the memory from here and then finding Windows 10 and putting it on there, and I didn't want to deal with all that, so I'm letting Asus deal with it and sending me the box, and I'll have it on the end of the month. To register participation for this week's episode of the Bobby Blackwolf Show on VogNetwork.com, use the passphrase PET. It looks like our guests are ready tonight, so we're going to stop talking about VR and start talking about ancient languages. So I'm going to call Andrew and Brenna Bird and see if they are ready. So Andrew and Brenna, are you guys there?
We're here.
Hi.
How you guys doing?
Doing well.
Good.
Doing well.
Andrew just got the little guy to sleep, so.
Yes. So you guys are linguists, and First, before we get into anything about the game, I want to talk about this. What made you want to become linguists? How did you get down this path personally?
Well,
you can go first.
Okay, yeah. I've always really found languages really fun. I've been taking German since, I think, 7th grade. And then in college, there were some required classes that I needed to take in older Germanic languages, and I just thought they were really fun. I thought they were kind of like puzzle pieces, and I ended up taking Russian too. And I took a class that was in linguistics, and I thought, wow, you mean you can do this? Because I started out computer science major, and I was like, wow, you mean I can just learn languages for a living and learn about languages and figure them out? So yeah, it was pretty early. I think it was more just the classes that I was taking. And then Andrew, you started out also as undergraduate for you too.
Yeah. So for your listeners, I actually know Bobby from way back when. We marched on the drum line together at the University of Georgia. And I went to Georgia to be a music major. Decided very quickly that it wasn't for me. I liked drumming, but I didn't like it that much. So I thought that I wanted to be a writer. And naively, I thought to be a good writer, you needed to know a lot of big words. A lot of those words come from Latin. So I started taking Latin, and I realized I liked Latin more than I liked writing. And then so my teacher was like, well, if you like Latin, you should try ancient Greek. I'm like, okay. So I did ancient Greek. And my teacher's like, well, if you like this, you should try Sanskrit. And then by the time that I graduated from Georgia, I think I'd studied like 15 ancient languages. And I just kind of fell into it. It certainly didn't know that I liked linguistics as much as I did. I didn't even know what linguistics was before Georgia, but it certainly was a good fit.
Yeah, see, I was going to ask, you know, why didn't you grow up to be something sensible like a band director like your brother?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, you know, so
because Josh already did that. Right?
Yeah, my older brother, he's the head band director at the University of West Georgia. He's very good at what he does, and you know, sibling rivalry and things like that. I probably moved away from it for that reason, but really, just I didn't like drumming that much, so that I wanted to do it all day long.
Right. So you guys are at the University of Kentucky now. Why Kentucky? Is it because there are still people in Kentucky that speak ancient languages?
It's funny. So we actually are really, really lucky and blessed as academic couples go. It's usually really hard for two people to find jobs at the same institution. I actually got the job first. It was a position specifically for pedagogy and second language acquisition and being in control of the graduate student instructors for the German program. And we moved here. It was the only job in the country that I got. it was either that or instructional technology. And so, which I like, but you know, it was the only professor job that year in the country for me, probably in the world. And we moved, and Andrew's job options were in Vienna or Oxford.
No. So Bobby, you joke about the sensible career like a band director, but you're absolutely correct. I mean, there are thousands of jobs for band directors. And when I got my PhD in Indo-European, there were two jobs in the world.
Yeah, and we didn't really want to move.
One was in Oxford, one was in Munich.
Munich, right. So, and we kind of wanted to stay a little closer to home. And so we came here, I got the job here. And then Andrew just walked up to the linguistics department and was like, here's my resume. Do you have any openings? And they're like, you're in luck. Somebody just quit 3 days ago. And he went from teaching part-time to then full-time. And now we both have tenure-track jobs. So we are super, super lucky, but it worked out. It was really awesome.
All right, so you've already mentioned Indo-European. So what is Indo-European? I know that's got a very short answer, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, really, so just as like, so you're down in Georgia and I'm up here in Kentucky. You know, we speak similar dialects, but slightly different. So if you listen to the Kentucky dialect, it's a little less nasally than the dialects spoken down in Tennessee and Georgia. That's a dialectal difference, right? But we can still understand each other. But imagine there is this massive wall constructed within the country.
Andrew.
Yeah. But imagine one were constructed, right? And people in Kentucky and people in Georgia could no longer communicate with each other for thousands of years. Well, those languages would change, right? So the words would change, the grammar would change, the sounds would change.
And actually, to bring up, this did happen in Germany. You have East, there are certain types of expressions and even accents and whatnot that are considered to be very East German. And, you know, and that was a much shorter period of time. So imagine if that then got multiplied. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, so the basic idea is that there are hundreds of languages that have been spoken in Europe and in Eurasia more generally that are related in that they used to be dialects of the same language, but over thousands of years they changed and changed and changed until they were no longer mutually intelligible, right? Now that whole big language family is called Indo-European. And if you study the languages, you look and see how they're related to each other, how they're similar to each other, you can actually figure out the source, right? You can figure out the various words for water and father and all the grammar and the word order and the sounds, everything. If you just look at it sound by sound, word by word, it's taken hundreds of years to really figure out what it looks like, but that's what we do.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I remember you were talking about, you know, the, how the language has changed, and you mentioned Germany. One thing I remember is I took Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And there was always the Mexican Spanish and the Spain Spanish, and I think it was like the vosotros.
Yeah,
pronoun.
So that would be a difference in lexicon or grammar or whatnot. So in Latin, there was a pronoun vos, mm-hmm. which meant y'all, right? And vos became vos within vulgar Latin, and that was inherited by, you know, Spanish. And then later, people started constructing other pronouns. So vosotros is literally y'all, others. So it's just basically like you all, right? All y'all, yeah. So different dialects have adopted different sorts of forms, right? But if you look at pronunciation, right? So within Castilian Spanish, so within Spain Spanish, they have things like ciento with a TH sound versus in Mexican Spanish and Latin American Spanish, they say ciento. In Mexican Spanish, you'll hear amigos with a final S. In Spain, you'll hear amigo with a final H. Mm-hmm. Right? So those are sound differences, but they can still understand each other. Just imagine hundreds, thousands of years will happen to make these things sound completely different.
So when we're speaking about like these hundreds, thousands of years, this is a question I've always wanted to ask, because like also like looking at like ancient Egyptian and stuff, how do we know we're even getting the pronunciation anywhere close? You know, like when somebody's reading the hieroglyphs and saying, oh, Tutankhamun. Like,
right.
If we went into a time machine and went back and said Tutankhamun, would they know what we're saying? Or they're like, no, it's not. It's not that.
Well, so
Egyptian's also difficult.
Is a very tricky situation.
Because they don't write the vowels.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
if you're actually looking at the hieroglyphics, it's just consonants. So you don't know, like, if you have a P and a T and an R, you don't even know, like, where the syllables are. You don't know if that's apter or Patra or Patar or whatever, you know. Of course, I'm saying this with a horrible American accent, but I'm trying to, you know, it's completely different. And so one of the things that we can figure out is from how things were pronounced is from when they're written in other languages. Like we have Cleopatra written in Greek, we have the name in a bunch of different, we have also other place names and things like that. We have them written down in other languages, and then we also have different versions that are related to ancient Egyptian, like Coptic, that would preserve some of those vowels. But yeah, I mean, take a time machine back in time, you're definitely going to have a funny accent. I mean,
Egyptian, too, is about the
Egyptian's
worst
really
language
hard
to really know what it sounded like.
Yeah.
Fortunately for Indo-European, all of the writing systems have vowels within them.
Yay.
Right. So there's not a single one that leaves out the vowels like what we see within Semitic, because vowels are very important within Indo-European in terms of, you know, understanding the sentence, right? Within Semitic and Hamito-Semitic, which is, you know, broader to include,
which are
Egyptian,
not Indo-European, by the
way. Yeah, those are not Indo-European.
Yeah.
The vowels can be left out and you can figure out what the vowels are through context, because the vowels will differ depending on the certain grammatical form.
So you're here on this show because you actually worked on a game. You worked on Far Cry Primal. So let's talk about that for a little bit. What did you guys exactly do for Far Cry Primal?
So we did a lot. So it was me and Bren and then three other friends, colleagues from UCLA. So we all knew each other in grad school. We sat down and we invented two languages for Far Cry Primal. Both of those languages were based off of Proto-Indo-European. One of the languages, Isilach, or Izila, is how everybody else in the world says it, that is essentially Proto-Indo-European with some simplifications. Now, Wenja, or Wenja, as you say it in the game, was designed to be the source of Proto-Indo-European. So it's like Proto-Indo-European. So we invented the languages. We translated about 40,000 words in the game. We created a lexicon of about 1,250 words for each language. We recorded every single word in the game for reference audio. We trained the actors how to speak the languages in the game, especially for the cinematics. And then at the very end, we did a lot of PR. So we did a lot of work for this.
So what does proto mean in this sense?
What do you mean?
The word you say it's Proto-Indo-European.
So by proto, you use the word proto in front of some sort of language or language family to say this is an earlier stage of this language and it's never been written down. So we don't know with 100% certainty that this is what it was, but we have a good scientific guess.
So we are actually taking questions. If you're listening live on the Voice of Geeks Network, head on over to live.vognetwork.com. Go into our chat room. Sky asks a question. For me, there's so much more to language than just verbal words. Expression and body language means so much. Did you have access to what the characters looked like and emoted in the game, and how did the visuals come to match the languages you guys created?
Yeah, no. So even from the very beginning, we were involved with the writers and the creative team and the directors on what we thought the tribal signatures were, as in, you know, the ideologies, the mythos, how the people think and how they move also. And so before we went up to work on the filming, the characters did a lot of body movement workshops, and we helped edit some of the script as well before, when we were trying to imagine, you know, what was the difference in these different tribes. And so and we worked with some just fantastic body movement coaches. Terry Notary is known for his work on Planet of the Apes. He also did he taught the actor who did Gollum how to move. He's really good at making people move differently than how they're used to. And then he also trained. So he came in for a couple different intense workshops. And then he trained also the movement coaches that Ubisoft use, Roberto Campanelli and
Campanella.
Sorry, I'm bad with the Italian. And sorry, my brain right now.
She's a little sick.
So yeah, sorry. I'm a little goofy. Hold on. No, don't do this to me.
I'm sorry. I was tweeting.
Why do you do this? I can't think.
Because I was so...
Yeah, now I can't think of...
So you're talking about... So Roberto and... You're talking
Anissa.
About movement. Anissa, yeah.
Roberto and Anissa. Okay, don't do that. I'm completely confused because he started typing. I was like, what? Sorry. So Roberto and Anissa were also two movement coaches. And so we would have sessions in the break room where the director would come in and want to discuss with us, you know, we need a body movement. We need a gesture for let your spirit walk free. So Takar has to have some kind of hand movement. And so we spent like an hour in the break room trying to figure out what that would look like. And, you know, I would videotape the director on my phone and be like, okay, you do it. And then I would show it to him what it looked like. And we'd talk about it. And Anissa worked in Africa. And so she would talk about, you know, different body languages that she had experienced from all over the world. And Roberta, we'd all kind of talk about, you know, well, this kind of a movement has this connotation in this culture. So what we tried to do with the body movement was make sure that it was something that naturally was interpretable so that when you're playing the game, you don't have to listen to the language. You can kind of figure out. But at the same time, it needed to not be something you can you could find in any modern culture. So it needed to be something that was both intuitive, but not something you would recognize. And that's actually really hard. So things like come here, you know, we couldn't use the, or pointing with your fingers or anything like this. We couldn't use those, but we had to do something that seemed intuitive also. So it was, there was a lot of thought that went into the body movement. Definitely.
Yeah. If you look at the NPCs or whatnot within the game, right, you can see how they walk, and they don't walk like a modern man. They walk with as little motion as is necessary. Like if you look at modern man walking, you know, we kind of trud along, right? Lots of wasted energy, and they took all that stuff out. Yeah, it was a lot of work.
So, Breakman, what Breakman got out of what you just said is that at Ubisoft they don't let you take breaks.
Man, I tell you, I've never worked so hard in my life. I loved it. I would do it again, you know, time permitting. But yeah, there, especially when we were doing shoots, mm-hmm. we would work 12-hour days for the shoots, and then we would go and translate more after that, or yeah. record more. I think some weeks we worked like 80 hours.
It was crazy.
A week. It was yeah. it was insane.
And Breakman also asked, you know, he kind of wants clarification. So was what you made kind of based on any real language that you can point to, or is it just that amalgamation?
Yeah. So to give you an example, so it was based off of Proto-European, but to give you an example as to how similar it is to English, the word for water in Izila is water, and the word for water in Winja is wadar. Right, so that's not us being lazy, you know, like I can't think of anything else besides water. This is because the word for water, that is water, within Proto-European was water.
Okay. Kaijudo asked a question. I don't know if I told you guys this. This is a family-friendly show, so don't translate any of these, but they wanted to know if you made any new swear words.
Yep.
Did you come for, and how many of them were there?
I'd say there's about 10 swear words within the game. Now, the funny thing is, so there's a character in the Far Cry universe named Herc. And Herc, we decided, needed to speak Winja with a southern accent, just like he speaks English within the normal Far Cry games. Mm-hmm. So
there's some comic relief, basically. That's what he is. He is total comic relief.
Because the game's very serious, you know. It's primal, you know. There's a lot of death. There's a lot of terror and things like that. But anyway, I can tell you some words. I won't translate them for you. But Pazdamazga is a very very filthy word. Fupalsikan is another filthy word. Langta, that means damn it. So I guess I can say that.
Yeah, that one's fine.
Hadsa is a part of your anatomy. Pasa is another part of your anatomy. Mm-hmm. These don't mean anything to you, but yeah, we had about 10 or 15 cuss words.
So how long really did you spend on these languages, and also kind of how long does it take to just even create a sentence? Like how long does it take to go through that process?
It just depends on where you are in the, I mean, when we were first starting, so we initially actually pitched different languages than the ones we ended up with. It depends on where we were in the process. There were some times when we were translating and especially Andrew just started because he would be working on the weekends and stuff. He could probably translate a line, especially the little barks. He could translate a line in like, you know, 30 seconds. But the beginning, it was every single word because we had to come up with a lexicon. It's not just the translating. You have to come up with a lexicon. And then each word has to be looked up in, you know, in Proto-Indo-European. What is it? And what's it based off of? Is it based off of Greek? What's the form in Greek? And how does it work? And, okay, well, what do we have anything in this? Or if we don't have it in the Indo-European lexicon, do we need to find another word that could possibly be? And so the beginning stage was very, very time consuming, but then as we started moving forward, it got a lot more doable.
Yeah, it was super hard in the beginning.
Yeah.
How many months did you spend working on the game altogether?
It's hard to...
Yeah, it's really hard to say. I can tell you that they brought us on board at the very beginning of the process. So they started working on this in the tail end of the development of Far Cry 4. So that was like
2014.
End of 2014, something like that.
Yeah.
It took us, I'd say, about four... maybe 5 months to really iron out the languages to, you know, to figure out that they sounded good, that they were pronounceable by the actors, that they were appropriate for the game and things like that.
So one question I had here is, you know, did you have any concessions that you had to make for game design reasons that you wouldn't have otherwise? Like, and what were some of those?
Yeah, I mean, it really came down to length. So there are two things. One is pronounceability, right? So if you go and you Google Proto-Indo-European, you'll find actually two recordings that I did about 3 years ago. And that's how Ubisoft found us, is through those recordings. But if you listen to Proto-Indo-European, people describe it often as a cross between Klingon and like German, or Klingon and Celtic,
Swedish
or something like that. And the reason a lot of people say Klingon is because there are a lot of really guttural sounds within the language. So we already knew from the very beginning that those sounds would have to be modified somewhat. Now, we held on to some of them for a long, long time, because essentially Proto-Indo-European without the guttural sounds is not really Proto-Indo-European. And we won. We got a lot of "h" sounds within the language. But we had to make the languages pronounceable. But we also had to make sure that the words within the language were not too long, because if you think about a lot of the interactions you have within a game like Far Cry, there are some things that you do within the cinematics, but the bulk of them are out in the open world, right? And you don't want someone talking to you for a minute and a half because each word is five syllables long, right? So a lot of times if we had a word that was too long, we would shorten it. We would do it, though, in a very sensible way. From a linguistics point of view, in a very sensible way.
Right. I mean, but I would also say that that's the kind of thing, like, we were forced to do that for the gameplay, but then when we started thinking about it, we're like, you know what? The people out in the real world don't pronounce everything exactly, you know, as it's written. I mean, this is also pre-writing, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I know I say probably instead of probably. Mm-hmm. Shortening stuff happens all the time. So, especially for small tribes, you know, people who know each other really well, there is going to be a lot of shortening. There is going to be a lot of stuff that gets shortened down to like one syllable, especially if you're in combat. So it made total sense. It just, at first, it was kind of hard for us to think about. And then we finally kind of understood it. Andrew had to buy a Far Cry 4 for, quote, research purposes.
Oh, God, I got to write that down for our taxes.
Oh, yeah.
No, that really helped. I had never played a Far Cry game before. Mm-hmm. It really helped to kind of give us a context. It's, okay, this is why they want us to change this word and that word. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, so you hadn't played a Far Cry game before, but are you guys gamers? What have you guys been playing?
Yeah, I'm a huge gamer. I've been gaming since I was four. I've been playing a lot of Far Cry Primal actually right now.
Yeah, I haven't gotten my chance yet. He's played it, he's beaten it, and then he's now back playing it on the hardest mode. So I haven't.
Yeah, I'm playing on expert and without the HUD, which is a lot of fun. Anyway, before that, I played Witcher 3. I love RPGs. That's usually my genre.
We used to play WoW together in grad school.
So SSJ100 Matt over at live.vognetwork.com, he asked, since the release of the game, have more companies like gaming or film or otherwise come forward seeking your help?
Not yet, but...
Do you work for someone?
Yeah. Not yet. I mean, so far it's just been interviews like crazy. But we have been seeing an interest in conlangs in general. There've been a bunch of new sci-fi series and things like that have had conlangs, and it seems to be on the rise. Maybe it's just that we're noticing it now more, but I kind of feel like there's more openness for conlangs, and or not just conlangs, but just proto-langs. I mean, it would be really cool if there were like a, I keep saying, I think it would be, I mean, there's a new Beowulf out. I think it would be fascinating if somebody did Beowulf in a proto-Germanic language, not an Old English language, because by the time Beowulf gets recorded, it's been oral tradition for, you know, a long time. I would love to see Beowulf in proto-Germanic, but I think that might be just a little too nerdy for most people.
Yeah, I think, you know, the risk that Ubisoft took was huge for doing the game in Pi, in Proto-Indo-European, right? Because usually with these AAA games, it's going to be in English and, you know, various other major languages spoken throughout the world. And we've been really happy to see how gamers have received this. They've either been like, yeah, okay, whatever, or been like, this is really awesome, this is really cool. I have a feeling that other games are gonna see the success of this, and Primal has been very successful from what I understand.
Conlangs, Breakman is constructed languages. So that's like Klingon or Dothraki or anything that's anything that's not spoken out in the real world before it's invented.
This should be a recon lang.
Yeah, this is a recon lang. I like it.
So I got to ask you guys, like, I mean, as linguists, have you studied the Klingon language, and was it a well-made language, or would you have done it differently if you were creating the language?
I don't know. So every linguist knows that in Klingon, the word for fish is choti, which is
a joke.
Is a joke because there's, anyway, if you look at G-H-O-T-I with an English that should spell fish, if you think of the words rough and women and nation, but at any rate, in terms of the grammar, I know that the language was designed to be alien. What was that?
Hello?
Yeah. We just heard a big boom.
Uh-oh. We didn't hear it on the stream.
That was kind of creepy. what was I saying? I don't honestly know about the structure. I know that people love it. I know that people have tried to teach their kids Klingon, and some people, you know, try to speak it in communities. I think it's fantastic.
Have you tried to teach your kid your language?
Yeah, actually. So he knows that he's our Sushnu, and he knows what Uhada means, and that means eat.
Sorry, that was the cat jumping down from licking stuff off of the counter. Stupid cat.
I'm definitely the older Alex gets, and he recognizes that it's fun to make up languages, so he now is just creating nonsense syllables. He's 3 years old, and he's like, am I doing good? Am I making up a language good? So I definitely want to speak Weenjo with him. And by the way, for the listeners out there, we've got a Twitter account, Speaking Primal. We post every day, and we've got a blog where we talk about the grammar, and we talk about various words and their sources and things like that.
And so, we'll take questions. Like, we had an email, some guy wants to speak Weenja fluently with his girlfriend,
yeah.
And so he was very confused about the verbs, so we did a little thing about, you know, how you say you've completed something. So it was pretty funny.
Yeah, and Kai Judo actually asked, he wants you guys to speak to each other in your new language.
Smadakaka, mu Andrew.
Mu Brenna, ukananyaha.
She just told me to go throw a chicken.
All right. So what do your students think of what you've been doing?
They think it's awesome. Really for us as educators, usually these topics are not, it's you got to spin these things a certain way to make them really interesting, but it's really easy to spin video games. So we just gave a public lecture here at UK at the University of Kentucky. I'd say about 900 people were at the lecture. They absolutely loved it. They were speaking some Weenja at the end. Nice.
Got a couple linguist majors out of it. It was
pretty
funny.
Yeah. No, it's been really, really cool.
Cool. Well, thank you guys so much for spending a Sunday night with
sure.
me. You guys are at Speaking Primal on Twitter, and you'll be taking questions there. And you don't know if you're going to be doing anything else next, but if anybody's listening to this podcast, they're available, maybe.
Yeah. Hey, pay us. We'll come down and give a talk. I was like, I was really hoping that we could do something at like a Comic Con, but yeah, all the booths got bought up at the Lexington Comic Con before we asked. And I was like, oh, sad. Cause that would be my dream. Like teach hundreds of people Leenja at a Comic Con. That would be pretty awesome.
There is, and I'm going to do this. We actually, one of our other podcasts on the network, he's in Louisville, Kentucky. Okay. And there is a convention there called Fandom Lowell. Fest. What was that?
It's not Louisville. Lowell.
Whatever. I'm from Georgia. I don't know these things.
I know. I'm from Texas.
It's Georgia.
And Dougs has five letters in it. But there's Fandom Fest in late July. So maybe try that. That's a kind of a nerdy convention in whatever that city is that starts with an L.
Lol. It's almost like you're saying lol.
You're screwing it up. You're not even doing it right.
So yeah, so look into that. I may actually be going up to that one too.
Yeah, sure, man.
Yeah, that'd be fun. I seriously would love, that would be like my dream to teach like hundreds of people Ouija. Just give me a PowerPoint projector type of thing and an audience, and I'm golden.
Well, let's make that happen. I'll talk offline with you guys.
Awesome.
So that's going to be the end of the interview. So thank you guys once again for doing this, and everybody go check out Speaking Primal. So thanks so much, guys.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Bye.
So that is it for me. I will be back next Sunday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, right here on the Voice of Geeks Network at VogNetwork.com. I will be taking calls probably next week and live chat and all that stuff right here at VogNetwork.com. You can leave me a bumper for use in the show on the toll-free number, 1-888-36-GAME-1, or you can email me an MP3 to bumpers@BobbyBlackWolf.com. Facebook.com/BobbyBlackWolf, Twitter @BobbyBlackWolf, that's where I am, or you can submit questions in the comments section of the episode at VogNetwork.com. Hey, if you like the show, tell a friend. If you hate the show, tell an enemy. I don't care. Just tell someone. The show is not for everybody, but it may be for somebody who does not know about it yet, but we would not be able to make the live show work without the help of the wonderful chatters who had some great questions tonight. Thank you so much. Dark Soccer, Dark Tid, Sia, DC, Nate, Hecht, Ronma, Sky, VXJSNXV, Doomplague, Fistream, Havoc978, Shadow Next Gen, Bacon Bits, Bob Coffee, Brad from Pod Culture, Breakman, Burr, Deborah Jean, Dr. Blue Guy, Fluke, Hitstun, Kaijudo, Kazan, Matt Cube, MXC, Raginator, SJ100 Matt, Tiger Claw, True, William Murderface, and Zeba. So thank you so much, everybody. We will be back next week in an all English language version of the Bobby Blackwell Show. And check out my little video on YouTube about driving to MacFest. See you guys next week. Bye.
A winner is you. The views and opinions expressed are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and are not necessarily the opinions of
the VOG Network, people who need to hire new voiceover guys,
or your mom, although if Bobby said it, it really should be. This has been a production of Bobby Blackwolf Studios.